This is NASCAR driver Tony Breininger inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Sociology, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Sarah Patterson, and today we will be talking with Stephen Roberts about his new book, Young Working Class Men in Transition. Welcome to the show, Stephen.
Thanks. Hello.
First, can you start us off by telling us about yourself?
So I'm an academic at Monash University in Melbourne, Australia, associate professor of sociology. And as you can probably tell by my accent, I'm not Australian. I'm English, but I live in Melbourne.
How did this book come about for you?
So this book is a long time in the making because it originated from my PhD studies. So from about 2008, 2009, and then is followed up and followed through with a more longitudinal approach to the same sample over the next 7 years. And the book stems from a long-standing interest in both youth studies and masculinity studies, and also, I guess, it came to me at this moment of understanding that the key text in my field, or one of the key texts in my field from the 1970s, Paul Willis's Learning to Labor. I just wondered what life was like compared to the life of lads, as he says, that he documented in the 70s, and whether and how much things had changed.
So you start the book off kind of theoretically, and you start in on what you call the crisis rhetoric in terms of theoretical background for what you study. So I was hoping you could sort of explain what that is for the listener and then how you use that in your study.
Sure. So the crisis rhetoric stuff is an important starting point for all masculinity studies of late, I think, because it's essentially this notion that because of economic and social transformation, the way that men can be men, like the way that they can perform and practice their gender identity or affirm their gender identity, has shifted. And then this causes a crisis for men and masculinity, such that the kind of common example is that in the contemporary world, where there is less heavy industry in Western nations because it's been outsourced or we just don't have it anymore because the economy has changed, that men can no longer do the kinds of jobs that their dads would have done or their dads' generations would have done. And that this creates a kind of incongruence for men such that they can't get the kind of esteem that was alleged to be available to their dad's generation. And the crisis rhetoric is an interesting thing. What I try to do in the book is follow the lead of a number of others actually. It's not a very original point, but it's a point that needs to be made over and over, which is that crisis rhetoric is kind of circular, and it comes around every decade. It's a very fixed thing in lots of ways because it's documented throughout history that are men having a crisis every time there's some kind of change. So in the book, I reference the role of empire, the changing role of empire, and the strength of the United States Army, for example, and the way that at the end of the 1800s, beginning of the 1900s, there's an investment in the idea that men need toughening up because masculinity is in crisis. And then in the 1930s, masculinity is in crisis again because of the Great Depression. So we have these like points in time where masculinity is raised as being in crisis, and that men are going to have a problem and they're not going to be able to connect to the social world around them and their expected social roles. And what does this mean for men? So the first part of the book is kind of sets this up. It talks about this discussion and actually kind of busts that myth that actually masculinity isn't in crisis, and that there is constant change, and yet the rhetoric of masculinity in crisis always emerges as if it's a problem, but it's a kind of a very simplified way of looking at things.
So then you move on to tackling some of the other theories that are often used in this literature, such as like hegemonic masculinity. So I was hoping you could sort of set the stage for your book, theoretically speaking.
Actually, I just realized that one thing I should add before I talk about hegemonic masculinity is that the issue of a masculinity in crisis, for example, one of the other things I try to stress in that, in those initial chapters, is that not only is crisis masculinity kind of a myth and an idea that needs to be busted, but I kind of perhaps quite provocatively suggest that a number of the key studies in the youth transitions literature, which is largely what I'm kind of speaking to or speaking from, I guess, they were the kind of studies that informed my PhD and beyond, was that their documentation of working class men through the 90s and early 2000s also seemed to, on the one hand, challenge the crisis rhetoric, but at the same time, portray young working class men in a very similar way, in ways that I actually describe as kind of underscoring crisis rhetoric in some way. So suggesting that young men are struggling with the changing gender order and changing economic and social landscape. So that's just that really important point. And then next, what I go into is, the theory of masculinity. So the classic theory of masculinity is Raywin Connell's hegemonic masculinity theory. And the idea is, I guess, in essence, is that there is a culturally ascendant form of masculinity, which all other men, all other masculinities, I guess, and therefore men who practice these masculinities operate in relation to. And this creates a hierarchy of masculinity such that Connell calls this the politics within masculinity. So it's not so much about, I mean, it is about the subordination of women actually, but the emphasis in one half of hegemonic masculinities, at least, is to think about the ways that some masculinities and therefore some men and other people that practice masculinities are either subordinated or marginalized in relation to hegemonic masculinity, this culturally idealized form, or masculinities that are complicit with hegemonic masculinity. So complicit masculinities being those men that benefit from what Connell calls the patriarchal dividend, and they might not necessarily be the frontline troops of patriarchy, but are in fact beneficiaries of the way that hegemonic masculinity works.
So you briefly mentioned this, but in terms of your focus of your study, you really focus on young men in transition. And here, what I found really interesting from the book is the idea of, you know, they're becoming something. And so I was hoping you could talk more about how you saw these kind of youth studies working into your research.
Yeah, in a funny way, it was kind of the other way around. Like, I started with youth studies. That was my area of interest when I was an undergraduate and then when I was a PhD student. And the kind of masculinity angle, which becomes kind of so central, came later. So I was a youth studies scholar or junior scholar, I guess, and I was fascinated by social and economic transformation and how that changed young people's transition through the world from school into school and education into the workplace, and these early years of navigating the labor market. And so youth study speaks a lot to this, and one of the key findings, I guess, of the late 90s and early 2000s was that young people's transitions to work were binarized. In fact, they were kind of divided along two tracks. So there's a writer called Jill Jones, and she talked about how young people's transition to work was either on a fast track or a slow track. And these kind of were demarcated by class in lots of ways, such that working class people want a fast track to the labor market from schools. That would mean they would more likely to leave school early, more likely to enter the labor market as soon as possible, more likely to have early age pregnancy and early partnership formation. And then middle class people on this slow track doing the opposite. So there was this notion that youth was becoming extended, at least for a significant proportion of people, when more and more people start going to university, for example. So there was a transformation in the way that young people move into the labor force compared to the previous generations, which was described in the kind of in the Fordist economy era, is described as this kind of one-step process from school into work. But in contemporary times, there's unemployment, there's extended education, there's a different number of steps which drags out or extends or even fragments the notion of becoming an adult, transitioning to adulthood, such that even moving out from the family home, or even especially, I guess, has become something that's much later as well than it used to be, because this is all bound up with one's education and one's engagement with the labor market and the ability to do so if the labor market is weak or the economy is fragile. Great.
So for the nerds in the audience, what are your specific methods that you use to sort of tackle this research idea?
So it's a qualitative study, and the original idea was, as I said before, is to get at whether or not things have changed since Paul Willis's days in the 70s and the lads that he wrote about. And so Paul Willis did a kind of conventional, probably wasn't so conventional for the time, but an ethnography. And I changed tact a little bit. I wanted to make the research participants be very central to the whole research process, but I decided to do kind of like biographical interviews, very loosely semi-structured biographical interviews. And this was the starting point. So actually, before I even really got into those interviews, I made sure I had at least one and oftentimes two kind of check-in interviews with the people that I was able to get to participate. And then it was, a case of loosely structured, semi-structured interviews with 24 young men, taking in their biography from kind of like secondary school age through to where they were at that point in time, which was 18 to 24. And the sample characteristics were like, it was quite contained, because another thing that I was really keen to do, what I felt youth studies hadn't done very well or very much of, was talk to people who I described as non-spectacular, or actually what I coined as the missing middle of youth studies. So young people who had some qualifications from school, but not many, not enough to go to higher education, and who weren't interested in higher education. So I found there was a gap here. So that was my kind of sample. And I went looking for these people in shops and high street retail, because as I noted before, the transformation of the economy is such that the kinds of jobs that would have been around in the 70s and 80s have gone. And there's a feeling in the literature that men especially don't do shop work. So I was interested to see what kinds of men do shop work. So the sample is 24 young men who work in frontline retail or service sector work, and who have what I described as moderate qualifications and were 18 to 24. So for in interviews, and then follow-up interviews after 16 months, and then another follow-up interview after that, a little while down the track, and then a 2-year Facebook ethnography, which included regular messenger contact and WhatsApp contact as well, prompted by the ethnography that I was observing. So the material that I saw online was the emphasis for questions and clarifications, I guess, through the messaging app processes and services.
So you referenced the middle ground, or this group of folks who you were looking at. And so, the missing middle. And then you start to talk about their sort of educational experiences. And here you bring up the idea of working class habitus and sort of the demands of the education system on these boys. So I was hoping you could sort of explain what that is and how you saw that coming out of your data.
Yeah. So I guess what was important was that, for me, the way that I could theorize and explain and explore these young men's experiences, that hegemonic masculinity theory alone wasn't going to be able to do everything that I wanted to do. So it would be able to explore the kind of more pernicious or negative dynamics of masculinity. But what I really wanted to do was get at the classed experience of education for men as well. So I draw on Pierre Bourdieu's idea of habitus, which is the kind of internalization of social structure that creates a set of dispositions and a set of ideas about the world. And specifically then in terms of education, this is about how young people come to feel like either a fish in water or a fish out of water. So do people feel compatible with their educational environment? And it's an idea that has a lot of purchase, and a lot of people have written about and used these concepts. And it helps us to understand the way that working class young people feel at odds with their educational environment, and moves away from a kind of psychological or individualist understanding where young people are seen as being troublemakers or somehow rejecting of education and disengaged, and instead gives an explanation around how working class people, especially, that their culture is not valued and their that they don't feel commensurate, I guess, with the educational environment, which is a much more middle class setting, or which rewards more middle class norms, and leads to young men especially feeling kind of out of sorts in the educational setting. And then this is a kind of explanatory device that allows us to get at, yeah, this is why people feel unsettled and disconnected. But I guess crucial to the empirical part of this, though, was that I kind of went in expecting more of this. But this middle ground orientation, this missing middle, they have a connection to education that is different to the way that Willis and others have described working class people. In fact, there was a very important book in the 80s written by Phil Brown about the ordinary majority, basically. And the men in my study conformed to this idea about being ordinary kids. Essentially, that they went to school and they didn't do especially well, but they also weren't especially disengaged. So there was this kind of middle ground theoretically that opened up, and which I speculate and theorize actually is probably what happens for the majority of kids. So even when we know that working class kids don't do as well at school as middle class kids, in fact, most of them kind of just get on with it, is the words that we use.
So then you explore their what is called post-16 education, and here you highlight some particular boys in their stories, like Mike. And so I was hoping you could sort of give us some of their stories.
Sure. Okay. Well, that's good. So the stories through to their kind of early 20s. Yeah. I mean, Mike in particular was a really interesting character, and kind of had a very, you know, as an interviewer, it was very distressing to hear about in lots of ways. So he had a difficult time. He had his handful of qualifications. He was going to college, but he didn't like college very much. But there was a tipping point, though, which was, I can't remember the exact order of this now, but there was a tipping point, which is his best friend was killed by a train, actually. So they were hanging out at a train station when they were kind of 17, I think. And the friend, for whatever reason, decided to cross the tracks rather than go over the bridge, and he was killed by a train. And then Mike mm-hmm. observes this, and this has a profound effect on Mike. So he becomes, not only is he relatively disengaged or kind of just getting on with it at school anyway, but the impact of this event is that he's obviously becomes depressed and very upset and uncontrollably crying for many weeks in a row, and he feels himself becoming more disengaged with the system. And then as he becomes disengaged with the system, he veers towards work, which is, again, a common kind of direction that working class people take. So he has a part-time job and he starts doing his job more than he does his school. And eventually education becomes something that is just in the background and disappears completely. So the point with Mike and with some of the others as well is there are kind of like pivotal moments that transform the possibilities of the direction of travel that they're about to take.
So then you move on to their paid work experiences, and you brought this up before, but one of the things that I found really interesting about this book is the focus on service work, because that often doesn't come up, men don't often come up in the narrative around service work. So I was hoping you could talk more about that.
The service work element is absolutely crucial to the whole book, I think, because yeah, the starting point was this idea that men don't do this kind of work. But actually, I don't remember the exact figures, but at the time, what really struck me was that when I looked at the labor force survey data, there were several hundred thousand men working in frontline service work at 18 to 24. And this wasn't, so I did some scoping of the labor force survey and just searched for people who weren't full-time students who were in the 18 to 24 category. And you could see this kind of very obvious spike in the data where, so retail and frontline service work, lots of young men worked there. And that was kind of a surprise based on what I'd seen in the literature. But it wasn't a surprise based on my feel for the world, because I felt that the economy had obviously transformed, and that shop work and customer service work was everywhere, and I felt like I'd seen people doing this, and yet the literature was telling us that men, young men especially, don't do this kind of work, and they reject it because it's at odds with manliness or at odds with traditional conventions of manliness. So the starting point was then to look at, well, if the labor force survey data is telling us there's this huge number of young men working in these kind of jobs, in fact more young men working in these kinds of jobs than the kinds of jobs that we traditionally might associate them with, so like building and construction and so on, these are actually quite small parts of the labor force, but lots of young men work in these kind of service sector roles. And so I was out to try and understand like what strategies these young men might use to reassert or reclaim a masculine identity when they are in service roles, which essentially or have been previously theorized as being emasculating. So the starting point was there. And at this point in time, so the first round of interviews, when they're kind of between 18 and 24, variously, most of them are kind of very early 20s. The surprising finding, I guess, in some ways, was that they weren't at odds with the service sector setting. And the reason I say surprising was because everything I'd read until that time was saying that boys can't do this. You know, they suffer from having to have an ingratiating manner. They suffer from having to hold their tongue. And probably the most famous book that I read at the time, Linda McDowell's book, Redundant Masculinity, speaks to this very clearly, that there is a struggle that boys have to do this kind of job. And it popped up in the literature all the time, but my findings were very clear that this wasn't the case. And actually that the strategies that the men employed were not so clear cut in terms of being about rescuing their masculine self or reasserting their masculine self. In fact, again, similarly to their school days, they just got on with it. And in fact, if anything, they quite enjoyed customer interaction. So I tried to problematize this notion that men can't do this kind of work. And in fact, what they didn't enjoy about the kind of work wasn't talking to people or serving people, but was the kind of monotony of being on a till point. And I make this very quick point in the book about how this is comparable to a factory production line. So it's the kind of classic Fordist production that they didn't like, because it not only gives them no autonomy, which but a lack of autonomy absolutely could be something that's something that they don't like because that masculinity is bound up with autonomy. But actually, I think it was more about class, about not having any autonomy or any freedom to do anything and do anything interesting, because the job working at a till point and just scanning items is kind of boring and monotonous. So in fact, what the guys did is said they embraced this kind of work, and that was, you know, that was the first big finding of the book and the first big finding of the research in those early days.
Another interesting part of this chapter is that you also investigate their sources of identity beyond employment. So can you tell us more about that?
Say that again, sorry.
Yeah, no problem. So another interesting thing about this chapter is that you also investigate other ways in which they identify or have a source of identity beyond their employment. So I was hoping you could talk more about that.
Yeah, sure. So I think that chapter, when I start talking about the other sources of identity, this is a kind of like later in the research process. So this was around the second interview time, so about 5 years after I first met them. And so it was kind of, I guess, the important starting point there is that I was catching up with them and first of all, identifying that most of them, in fact, didn't remain in frontline service work. And yet it wasn't because they hadn't exited frontline service work because they were pursuing manliness, but actually they were pursuing better wages, which we might say is related to manliness in some ways. But actually what they were doing was pursuing better wages because they needed to pay their bills, and they needed to help support their families with their partners, or they needed to have enough money to move out. So they were trying to better their prospects, like many of us do, by trying to get the best wages possible. And they felt this was outside of the service sector that was notoriously poorly paid and often part-time. So with the kind of search for identity in other spaces, I picked this up in the second or third round of interviews, so 5 years on from the first one. And the idea there was that it kind of complicated the first set of findings, because I was able to see that they do in fact dig around looking for these avenues to reinforce traditional forms of masculinity. So, and they never spoke about it in this way, of course. So this was very much a kind of sociologist interpretive lens. But for example, there was one guy who invested strongly as an individual in the collective experience of going to international soccer matches, which is, it was really fascinating to me because he didn't talk about this in his first interview, but when I met him later, he'd become this, described him as the football guy because, or he described himself as the football guy actually, that people know him as this guy that takes, like, saves his money and goes on international trips to Europe and attends football matches and becomes like part of this mass of what is mostly men, and enjoying this kind of experience that is associated with working class masculinity, both at the individual and collective level. So there was that. And there was another guy who having worked a number of jobs and left the service sector, he tried to become a prison guard and that didn't work. And what he ended up doing was becoming a mobile DJ. And but he talked about how this gave him capital and status. And again, in ways he would never describe it as being about manliness, but he did reference like his attractiveness to women, for example. In fact, the way, quote unquote, he could get women as a result of his job. So yeah, there were a number of occasions where it was quite clear to me that men were seeking sources of identity that consolidate manliness, even if they weren't prepared to kind of like say that's exactly what it was about.
So then in chapter 7, you get into a topic that comes up a lot in gender research, which is domestic responsibilities. So things like housework. And here you talk a little bit about how the boys sometimes internalize these ideas of like gender essentialism. And one of the boys actually says that says that, you know, that women are more often offended by a mess, which I kind of got a laugh out of. But I was hoping you could talk about the young men in your sample and how they kind of, you know, experience and see domestic responsibilities.
Yeah. So, so chapter 7 is about the attitudes towards the domestic sphere. And in this first set of interviews, so chapter 7 is both the initial interviews and the later interviews as well. And when they're kind of in their early 20s, they have these ideas where they look towards the future and imagine equal shares of domestic responsibility. And rather than seeing that this is, again, like there's no kind of understanding that this might be incompatible with manliness or whatever, they talked in very egalitarian ways. And what was interesting, though, is that as they progressed and they got a bit older, and after, you know, 5 years later, many of them did have partners. This was kind of still there in some of their ideals, but not others. And as you mentioned, that one of the kind of funny parts, and although the idea of men, women being more offended by mess, which was really amusing to me, but also was a kind of constant theme as well, that other men, for example, talked around, like if you see where men live, like the reality is that men do actually live like that, where women kind of socialize not to live like that. And so there was this slight incongruence. And in fact, there was also a really like nice moment where one of the young men has a really kind of like reflective light bulb moment where he's talking about how he also contributes, and if he will leave stuff, and you know, they both do stuff together, but sometimes he will leave stuff and the partner will pick up and tidy up after him. And he kind of has this light bulb moment that he realizes in fact he is a beneficiary, even though he technically doesn't care about the mess, that he's also a beneficiary of his partner tidying up after him when he won't or seemingly isn't bothered by it. So this whole chapter is it's kind of, it gets at the visions of routine housework, looks at the ways that attitudes towards traditional gender ideology are supported, but in other ways how they're altered a little bit. And what I tried to draw on here was that, again, this is kind of a small point but an important point, that because I don't have a comparator as such, like I'm not talking to middle class men as well, but the way I was able to at least frame the working class men's responses or attitudes at least was through this notion of or in comparison to working middle class people, is that middle class men are often described as speaking egalitarianism in terms of the domestic setting. But what we know actually is that working class men are more likely to have to practice at least some level of egalitarianism or have a different kind of relationship with domestic work because of the need, like the financial need for two people to go to work in a working class household now more than ever, means it kind of throws up a different set of dynamics. And I think for these young men especially, you can see this kind of like attenuation of the older model of masculinity towards an understanding that there is a reliance on a model of more like being a teammate, basically, of having to do something because both partners have to work. And, you know, one of the guys talks about a time when he was not working, which meant he was unemployed, and he makes sure the house is tidy. And he speaks in very kind of straightforward terms that it's not on for his partner to have to come home and tidy the house or cook the kids tea and this kind of stuff when she's been working all day. And yet at the same time, it's not this gender utopia. There are definitely elements of where the boys and the young men even seem kind of like lazier or happy to let women get on with it. But then also there's another interesting point, I think, which is that in terms of being with their children, like children, the men that do have children are very involved, but they also all recognize the kind of institutional and structural constraints around like who gets maternity leave and how that prevents them from engaging with their children. So even if they were completely egalitarian and they wanted a complete shared relationship in terms of domestic and domestic labor and childcare, that they wouldn't quite be able to achieve it.
So then you turn to intimacy and expressions of emotions, and I thought that this was really interesting because this comes up when you start to use Facebook to interact with them. So I was hoping you could talk more about what you found here.
So this was chapter 8. Talk about intimacy and expressions of emotion. And this emerged through the Facebook ethnography without question, and also through some interviewing as well. But the starting point again was what do we know? Like what does the existing literature talk about? And there is quite a lot of discussion around how young working class men especially cannot emote, you know, that they're unable to do so, and that being emotional, demonstrating your emotions is at odds with your masculinity. And I kind of found that the opposite of that in lots of ways, that there was a very pronounced openness, and you know, the idea that young men are kind of have their gender performance policed and they don't emote, and all this stuff that's kind of linked to being, you know, quote unquote, being a sissy or whatever. This just wasn't apparent. And in fact, there were multiple ways in which young men were demonstrating their emotions and their feelings. And these affective dimensions were so kind of present, and it really struck me as being at odds with the idea that not only that men can't do this, but that the emotionality was central to their lives rather than just being like some theorists talk about how men can be emotional in situationally appropriate spaces and places. So like, for example, at a funeral, like some writers talk about how men can have their masculinity consolidated and enhanced by demonstrating that moment of weakness in the right place. But that largely men are supposed to avoid this kind of discussion and performance of gender, a performance of emotions. But there are just so many, I wouldn't even know where to begin. So what I try to detail in the book is how there are posts that people make on Facebook around love and sadness and friendship. And then in the interview setting, there was a really terrific interview, which was done kind of asynchronously through Facebook Messenger app. And this one guy, Gavin, as he's called in the book, he just gave me the really, really long response to what was a very simple question. And it was uninterrupted. In the book, I have interrupted it because it was so long. It would have taken 3 pages of the text just to write out the whole quote. And originally, I had wanted to keep it in there, but it was kind of a long and grueling read because the emotion present in this conversation was first of all, starting around his relationship with his parents, and then the fact that his partner had lost the baby 2 days after the baby was born. And so then he was talking about how this had had an impact on him. And then later than when they had another baby about 2 years later or 3 years later, he described in such vivid ways his fear of that moment emerging again. So yeah, like fear and happiness and love and pride and anger, all of these things were so present. And I just was really struck by how the masculinities literature is a little bit complicit in talking about men in very narrow ways. And I think that's because we don't want to get away from the idea that there are lots of problems with masculinity. But what's interesting to me is that these problems remain even when men are being more emotional. So the answer isn't, for example, let's make sure men are more emotional and then the problems with masculinity will disappear, because some of the issues remain. And in fact, part of that chapter does explore some of this as well, that in terms of friendship, for example, the men did still use gay slurs and sexist language and this kind of stuff, quite misogynistic behavior at times in their friendship groups. And that was a way of consolidating their bonding with their friends. So there were still like problems with that. But even there, what was particularly interesting and of course not perfect and still problematic, but was this kind of very ingrained understanding that the men would not, or they claimed at least, they claimed they would not use this kind of language outside of an inner circle because they know its potential to offend, and that they wouldn't want to offend their gay peers, their gay friends, or anyone who they didn't know who was gay, for example. But that they use this this kind of derogatory language in a socio-positive way, which isn't, you know, as I want to underscore, this is not unproblematic at all, but it's different to the idea of deploying homophobic slurs as a specific method of emasculating someone and humiliating someone.
Yeah, I found that to be really interesting. So here I was hoping you could give us sort of what you really feel like are the big takeaways from your book.
What I tried to do, as I mentioned at the beginning, I talked about how this was closely related to the youth studies literature. But actually, one of the kind of key points is that I think I've spoken to long-standing calls for focus on the ways that marginalized and subordinated masculinities have transformed. So Michael Messner talked about this in 1993. So we're talking 25 years ago, and he made this point. And I think that still hadn't been done very well over the last 25 years. And up until more recently, James Messerschmidt also used similar language, talking about how we need to know more about different types of masculinity. So to distinguish between dominant, dominating, and non-hegemonic forms of masculinity. So the take home was, I think, by looking at these, exploring these and kind of identifying these kind of non-hegemonic forms or slightly less than hegemonic forms of masculinity, that first of all, that working class masculinity, the narrative around working class masculinity needs to be disrupted, because I think both the media and in political circles, and in fact, it's quite sad for me to say this, but I think in a lot of academic work as well, young working class men are held up as being a problem, inherently problematic. And I think this demonization is about working class culture more than it is about masculinity per se, because what I really want to stress that the book illustrates the kind of ordinariness in lots of ways, the everyday nature of being a working class man isn't imbued with all of the problematic elements of masculinity, because those problematic elements exist, but they're not the property of the working classes. In fact, they, you know, if we looked across the class spectrum, we would see them everywhere. We would see misogyny and homophobia and commitment to particular gender ideals across the spectrum, but they're discussed in different ways. They emerge in different ways. And often we spend too much time focusing on how bad young working class men are. And actually, the kind of key theoretical point for me is that in terms of the transformation of the economy and social transformation and 40 years of important gender scholarship and feminist activism, these have had a drip effect on the way that masculinity can be performed and expressed in the contemporary world. And we need to harness that transformation, harness the positive aspects of that transformation if we are to have even more progress. And I was really reluctant to build into this argument that things have never changed or that it's only superficial, because even if the dial has only shifted very slightly, to shift that dial even further, we can't keep characterizing these people as being inherently problematic and kind of terrible. Mm-hmm.
Great, thank you for that. So today we've been talking to Stephen Roberts about his new book, Young Working Class Men in Transition. So what are you working on now, Stephen?
So now I'm working on another project to do with masculinity as well, but in the Australian context. And I'm looking at the relationship between alcoholic drinking, risky drinking, actually, and how masculinity enhances this and the role that masculine norms have in heavy drinking.
Great. Well, if you end up writing a book, you know where to find us. So thank you for being with us today, Stephen.
Yeah, thanks for having me.